Above him the sky is an infinitely clear, dark blue. Around him the hay in Timothy is rib-high instead of ankle-high. There has been no Bunny Betcher in this part of creation to cut it. In fact, there is no house back the way he came, only a picturesque old barn with a windmill standing off to one side. "Where are the flying men?" Jack thinks, looking up into the sky, then shakes his head briskly. No flying men, no two-headed parrots, no werewolves. All that was Seabrook Island stuff. A neurosis he picked up from his mother and even passed on to Richard for a while. It was all nothing but bullshit. He accepts this, knowing at the same time that the real bullshit would be not believing what's all around him. The smell of the grass, now so strong and sweet, mixed with the more flowery smell of clover and the deeper basso profundo smell of black earth. The endless sound of the crickets in this grass, living their unthinking cricket lives, the fluttering white field moths. The unblemished cheek of the sky, not marked by a single telephone wire or electrical cable or jet contrail. What strikes Jack most deeply, however, is the perfection of the field around him. There's a matted circle where he fell on his knees, the dew-heavy grass crushed to the ground. But there is no path leading to the circle, not a mark of passage through the wet and tender grass. He might have dropped out of the sky. That's impossible, of course, more Seabrook Island stuff, but I did sort of fall out of the sky, though. Jack says in a remarkably steady voice. I came here from Wisconsin. I flipped here. Richard's voice protests this strenuously, exploding in a flurry of harumps and bahas, but Jack hardly notices. It's just good old rational Richard doing his rational Richard thing inside his head. Richard had lived through stuff like this once before and come out the other side with his mind more or less intact. But he'd been 12. They'd both been 12 that fall, and when you're 12, the mind and body are more elastic. Jack has been turning in a slow circle, seeing nothing but open fields, the mist over them now fading to a faint haze in the day's growing warmth, and blue-gray woods beyond them. Now, there's something else. To the southwest, there's a dirt road about a mile away. Beyond it, at the horizon, or perhaps just beyond, the perfect summer sky is a little stained with smoke. Not wood stoves, Jack thinks, not in July, but maybe small manufactories. And he hears a whistle, three long blasts made faint with distance. His heart seems to grow large in his chest, and the corners of his mouth stretch up in a kind of helpless grin. The Mississippi's that way, by God, he says, and around him the field moths seem to dance their agreement, lace of the morning. That's the Mississippi, or whatever they call it over here. And the whistle, friends and neighbors. Two more blasts roll across the making summer day. They are faint with distance, yes, but up close they would be mighty. Jack knows this. That's a riverboat. A damn big one. Maybe a paddle-wheeler. Jack begins to walk toward the road, telling himself that this is all a dream, not believing a bit of that, but using it as an acrobat uses his balance pole. After he's gone 100 yards or so, he turns and looks back. A dark line cuts through the Timothy, beginning at the place where he landed and cutting straight to where he is. It is the mark of his passage. The only mark of it. Far to the left, in fact almost behind him now, is the barn and the windmill. That's my house and garage, Jack thinks. At least that's what they are in the world of Chevrolet's Mideast Warfare and the Oprah Winfrey Show. He walks on and has almost reached the road when he realizes there is more than smoke in the southwest. There is a kind of vibration as well. It beats into his head like the start of a migraine headache. And it's strangely variable. If he stands with his face pointed dead south, that unpleasant pulse is less. Turn east, and it's gone. North, and it's almost gone. Then, as he continues to turn, it comes all the way back to full. Worse than ever now that he's noticed it, the way the buzz of a fly or the knock of a radiator in a hotel room is worse after you really start to notice it. Jack turns another slow, full circle. South, and the vibration sinks. East, it's gone. North, it's starting to come back. West, it's coming on strong. Southwest, and he's locked in like the seek button on a car radio. Pow, pow, pow. A black and nasty vibration like a headache. A smell like ancient smoke. No, no, no. Not smoke, Jack says. He's standing almost up to his chest in summer grass, pants-soaked, white moths flitting around his head like a half-assed halo, eyes wide, cheeks once more pale. In this moment, he looks 12 again. It is eerie how he has rejoined his younger and perhaps better self. Not smoke. That smells like... He suddenly makes that irking sound again, because the smell, not in his nose but in the center of his head, is rotted baloney, the smell of Irma Freneau's half-rotted, severed foot. "I'm smelling him," Jack whispers, knowing it's not a smell he means. He can make that pulse whatever he wants, including, he realizes, gone. "I'm smelling the fisherman. Either him or... I don't know." He starts walking, and 100 yards later he stops again. The pulse in his head is indeed gone. It has faded out the way radio stations do when the day warms and the temperature thickens. It's a relief. Jack has almost reached the road, which no doubt leads one way to some version of Arden and the other way to versions of Centralia and French Landing, when he hears an irregular drumming sound. He feels it as well, running up his legs like a Gene Krupa backbeat. He turns to the left, then shouts in mingled surprise and delight. 3 enormous brown creatures with long, lolloping ears go leaping past Jack's position, rising above the grass, sinking back into it, then rising above it again. They look like rabbits crossed with kangaroos. Their protruding black eyes stare with comic terror. Across the road they go, their flat feet white-furred instead of brown, slapping up dust. "Christ!" Jack says, half laughing and half sobbing. He whacks himself in the center of his forehead with the heel of his palm. "What was that, Richie boy? Got any comments on that?" Richie, of course, does. He tells Jack that Jack has just suffered an extremely vivid, hallucination. "Of course," Jack says, "giant bunny rabbits. Get me to the nearest AA meeting." Then, as he steps out onto the road, he looks toward the southwestern horizon again, at the haze of smoke there, a village. And do the residents fear, as the shadows of the evening come on, fear the coming of the night, fear the creature that is taking their children? Do they need a coppiceman? Of course they do. Of course they... Something is lying on the road. Jack bends down and picks up a Milwaukee Brewers baseball cap, jarringly out of place in this world of giant hopping range rabbits, but indubitably real. Judging from the plastic adjustment band in the back, it's a child's baseball cap. Jack looks inside, knowing what he'll find, and there it is, carefully inked on the bill, Time Marshall. The cap's not as wet as Jack's jeans, which are soaked with morning dew, but it's not dry either. It has been lying here on the edge of the road, he thinks, since yesterday. The logical assumption would be that Ty's abductor brought Ty this way, but Jack doesn't believe that. Perhaps it is the lingering pulse of vibration that gives rise to a different thought, a different image. The fisherman, with Ty carefully stashed away, walking out this dirt road. Under his arm is a wrapped shoebox decorated with bogus stamps. On his head is Ty's baseball hat, kind of balancing there because it's really too small for the fisherman. Still, he doesn't want to change the adjustment band, doesn't want Jack to mistake it for a man's cap, even for a single second. Because he is teasing Jack, inviting Jack into the game. "Took the boy in our world," Jack mutters. "Escaped with him to this world. stashed him someplace safe, like a spider stashing a fly. Alive? Dead? Alive, I think. Don't know why. Maybe it's just what I want to believe. Leave it. Then he went to wherever he stashed Irma, took her foot and brought it to me, brought it through this world, then flipped back to my world to leave it on the porch. Lost the hat on the way, maybe? Lost it off his head? Jack doesn't think so. Jack thinks this fuck, this scowl, this world-hopping dirtbag left the cap on purpose. Knew that if Jack walked this road, he'd find it. Holding the hat to his chest like a Miller Park fan showing respect to the flag during the national anthem, Jack closes his eyes and concentrates. It's easier than he would have expected, but he supposes some things you never forget. How to peel an orange, how to ride a bike, how to flip back and forth between worlds. "Boy, like, you don't need no cheap wine anyhow," he hears his old friend Speedy Parker say, and there's the edge of a laugh in Speedy's voice. At the same time, that sense of vertigo twists through Jack again. A moment later, he hears the alarming sound of an oncoming car. He steps back, opening his eyes as he does so, catches a glimpse of a tarred road, Norway Valley Road, but a horn blares, and a dusty old Ford slams by him, the passenger side view mirror less than 9 inches from Jack Sawyer's nose. Warm air, once again filled with the faint but pungent odor of hydrocarbons, surfs over Jack's cheeks and brow, along with some farm kid's indignant voice. "Hell out of the road, asshole!" "Resent being called an asshole by some cow college graduate," Jack says in his best rational Richard voice. And although he adds a pompous "baha" for good measure, his heart is pumping hard. Man, he'd almost flipped back right in front of that guy. "Please, Jack, spare me," Richard said. "You dreamed the whole thing." Jack knows better. Although he looks around himself in total amazement, the core of his heart isn't amazed at all. No, not even a little bit. He still has the cap, for one thing, Time Marshall's brewer's cap, and for another, the bridge across Tamarack Creek is just over the next rise. In the other world, the one where giant rabbits went hopping past you, he has walked maybe a mile. In this one, he's come at least 4. That's the way it was before, he thinks. That's the way it was when Jackie was 6, when everybody lived in California and nobody lived anywhere else. But that's wrong. Somehow wrong. Jack stands at the side of the road that was dirt a few seconds ago and is tarred now, stands looking down into Time Marshall's baseball cap, and trying to figure out exactly what is wrong and how it's wrong, knowing he probably won't be able to turn the trick. All that was a long time ago, and besides, he's worked at burying his admittedly bizarre childhood memories since he was 13. More than half his life, in other words. A person can't dedicate that much time to forgetting, then suddenly just snap his fingers and expect... Jack snaps his fingers, says to the warming summer morning, what happened when Jackie was 6? And answers his own question. When Jackie was 6, Daddy played the horn. What does that mean? Not Daddy, Jack says suddenly. Not my Daddy, Dexter Gordon. The tune was called Daddy Played the Horn. Or maybe the album, the LP. He stands there, shaking his head, then nods. Plays. Daddy plays. Daddy plays the horn. And just like that, it all comes back. Dexter Gordon playing on the hi-fi. Jackie Sawyer behind the couch playing with his toy London taxi, so satisfying because of its weight, which somehow made it seem more real than a toy. His father and Richard's father talking, Phil Sawyer and Morgan Sloat. Imagine what this guy would be like over there, Uncle Morgan had said, and that had been Jack Sawyer's first hint of the territories. When Jackie was 6, Jackie got the word. And when Jackie was 12, Jackie actually went there, he says. Ridiculous, Morgan's son trumpets. Utterly ridiculous. Next you'll be telling me there really were men in the sky. But before Jack can tell his mental version of his old pal that or anything else, another car arrives. This one pulls up beside him. Looking suspiciously out of the driver's window, the expression is habitual, Jack has found, and means nothing in itself, is Alvina Morton, Henry Layden's housekeeper. "What in the tarnal are you doing way down here, Jack Sawyer?" she asks. He gives her a smile. "Didn't sleep very well, Mrs. Morton. Thought I'd take a little walk to clear my head." "And do you always go walking through the dews and the damps when you want to clear your head?" she asks, casting her eyes down at his jeans, which are wet to the knee and even a bit beyond. "Does that help?" "I guess I got lost in my own thoughts," he says. "I guess you did," she says. "Get in and I'll give you a lift most of the way back to your place. Unless, that is, you've got a little more head-clearing to do." Jack has to grin. That's a good one. Reminds him of his late mother, actually. When asked by her impatient son what was for dinner and when it would be served, Lily Cavanaugh was apt to say, "Fried farts with onions, wind pudding, and air sauce for dessert. Come and get it at 1:30 a pickle." "I guess my head's as clear as I can expect today," he says, and goes around the front of Mrs. Morton's old brown Toyota. There's a brown bag on the passenger seat with leafy stuff poking out of it. Jack moves it to the middle, then sits down. "I don't know if the early bird gets the worm," she says, driving on, "but the early shopper gets the best greens at Roy's, I can tell you that. Also, I like to get there before the layabouts." "Layabouts, Mrs. Morton?" She gives him her best suspicious look, eyes cutting to the side, right corner of her mouth quirked down as if at the taste of something sour. "Take up space at the lunch counter and talk about the fisherman this and the fisherman that, who he might be, what he might be, a Swede or a Pole or an Irish, and, of course, what they'll do to him when he's caught, which he would have been long ago if anyone but that nummy square-head Dale Gilbertson was in charge of things. So, says they, easy to take charge when you got your ass cozied down on one of Roy Soderholm's stools, cup of coffee in one hand and a sinker in the other, so thinks I. Of course, half of 'em's also got the unemployment check in their back pockets, but they won't talk about that. My father used to say, 'Show me a man who's too good to hay in July, and I'll show you a man that won't turn a hand the rest of the year neither.'" Jack settles in the passenger bucket, knees against the dash, and watches the road unroll. They'll be back in no time. His pants are starting to dry, and he feels oddly at peace. The nice thing about Alvina Morton is that you don't have to hold up your end of the conversation, because she is glad to take care of everything. Another Lilyism occurs to him. Of a very talkative person, Uncle Morgan, for instance, she was apt to say that so-and-so's tongue was hung in the middle and running on both ends. He grins a little and raises a casual hand to hide his mouth from Mrs. M. She'd ask him what was so funny, and what would he tell her? That he had just been thinking her tongue was hung in the middle? But it's also funny how the thoughts and memories are flooding back. Did he just yesterday try to call his mother, forgetting she was dead? That now seems like something he might have done in a different life. Maybe it was a different life. God knows he doesn't seem like the same man who swung his legs out of bed this morning, wearily, and with a feeling best described as doomish. He feels fully alive for the first time since Dale first brought him out this very same road, he supposes, and showed him the nice little place that had once belonged to Dale's father. Alvina Morton, meanwhile, rolls on. "Although I also admit that I take any excuse to get out of the house when he starts with the mad mongoloid," she says. The mad mongoloid is Mrs. Morton's term for Henry's Wisconsin rat persona. Jack nods, understanding, not knowing that before many hours are past, he will be meeting a fellow nicknamed the Mad Hungarian. Life's little coincidences. "It's always early in the morning that he takes it into his head to do the mad mongoloid, and I've told him, 'Henry, if you have to scream like that and say awful things, and then play that awful music by kids who never should have been let near a tuba, let alone an electrical guitar, why do you do it in the morning when you know it spoils you for the whole day?' And it does. He gets a headache 4 times out of every 5 he pretends to be the mad mongoloid, and by afternoon he's lying in his bedroom with an ice bag on his poor forehead, and not a bite of lunch will he take on those days, neither. Sometimes his supper will be gone when I check the next day. I always leave it in the same place in the refrigerator, unless he tells me he wants to cook himself. But half the time it's still there, and even when it's gone, I think that sometimes he just tips it down the garbage disposer. Jack grunts. It's all he has to do. Her words wash over him, and he thinks of how he will put the sneaker in a baggie, handling it with the fire tongs, and when he turns it over at the police station, the chain of evidence will begin. He's thinking about how he needs to make sure there's nothing else in the sneaker box, and check the wrapping paper. He also wants to check those sugar packets. Maybe there's a restaurant name printed under the bird pictures. It's a long shot, but... And he says, Mrs. M., I can't help it. Some days I just wake up as the rat. And although I pay for it later, there's such joy in it while the fit is on me. Such total joy. And I asked him, I said, how can there be joy in music about children wanting to kill their parents and eat fetuses and have sex with animals, as one of those songs really was about, Jack. I heard it clear as day, and all of that. I asked him, and he said, oh, here we are. They have indeed reached the driveway leading to Henry's house. A quarter of a mile further along is the roof of Jack's own place. His Ram pickup twinkles serenely in the driveway. He can't see his porch, most certainly can't see the horror that lies upon its boards, waiting for someone to clean it up, to clean it up in the name of decency. "I could run you all the way up," she says. "Why don't I just do that?" Jack, thinking of the sneaker and the rotten baloney smell hanging around it, smiles, shakes his head, and quickly opens the passenger door. "Guess I need to do a little more thinking after all," he says. She looks at him with that expression of discontented suspicion, which is, Jack suspects, love. She knows that Jack has brightened Henry Layden's life, and for that alone he believes she loves him. He likes to hope so, anyway. It occurs to him that she never mentioned the baseball cap he's holding, but why would she? In this part of the world, every man's got at least four. He starts up the road, hair flopping. His days of styled cuts at Shea Shea on Rodeo Drive are long behind him now. This is the coolie country, and when he thinks of it at all, he gets his hair cut by old Herb Roper down on Chase Street next to the Amvets. His gait as loose and lanky as a boy's. Mrs. Morton leans out her window and calls after him, "Change out of those jeans, Jack, the minute you get back. Don't let them dry on you. That's how arthritis starts." He raises a hand without turning and calls back, "Right." 5 minutes later, he's walking up his own driveway again. At least temporarily, the fear and depression have been burned out of him. The ecstasy as well, which is a relief. The last thing a coppiceman needs is to go charging through an investigation in a state of ecstasy. As he sights the box on the porch, and the wrapping paper, and the feathers, and the ever-popular child sneaker, can't forget that, Jack's mind turns back to Mrs. Morton, quoting that great sage Henry Layden. "I can't help it. Some days I just wake up as the rat, and although I pay for it later, there's such joy in it while the fit is on me. Such total joy." Total joy. Jack has felt this from time to time as a detective, sometimes while investigating a crime scene, more often while questioning a witness who knows more than he or she is telling. And this is something Jack Sawyer almost always knows, something he smells. He supposes carpenters feel that joy when they are carpentering particularly well. Sculptors, when they're having a good nose or chin day, architects, when the lines are landing on their blueprints just right. The only problem is, someone in French Landing, maybe one of the surrounding towns, but Jack is guessing French Landing, gets that feeling of joy by killing children and eating parts of their little bodies. Someone in French Landing is more and more frequently waking up as the fisherman. Jack goes into his house by the back door. He stops in the kitchen for the box of large-size baggies, a couple of wastebasket liners, a dustpan, and the whisk broom. He opens the refrigerator's ice maker compartment and loads about half the cubes into one of the plastic liners. As far as Jack Sawyer is concerned, Irma Freneau's poor foot has reached its maximum state of decay. He ducks into his study, where he grabs a yellow legal pad, a black marker, and a ballpoint pen. In the living room, he gets the shorter set of fire tongs. And by the time he steps back onto the porch, he has pretty much put his secret identity as Jack Sawyer aside. "I am Coppiceman," he thinks, smiling, "defender of the American way, friend of the lame, the halt, and the dead." Then, as he looks down at the sneaker, surrounded by its pitiful little cloud of stink, the smile fades. He feels some of the tremendous mystery we felt when we first came upon Irma in the wreckage of the abandoned restaurant. He will do his absolute best to honor this remnant, just as we did our best to honor the child. He thinks of autopsies he has attended, of the true solemnity that lurks behind the jokes and butcher shop crudities. "Irma, is it you?" he asks quietly. "If it is, you help me now. Talk to me. This is the time for the dead to help the living." Without thinking about it, Jack kisses his fingers and blows the kiss down toward the sneaker. He thinks, "I'd like to kill the man, or the thing, that did this. String him up alive and screaming while he filled his pants. Send him out in the stink of his own dirt." But such thoughts are not honorable, and he banishes them. The first baggie is for the sneaker with the remains of the foot inside it. Use the tongs, zip it closed, mark the date on the baggie with the marker. Note the nature of the evidence on the pad with the ballpoint. Put it in the wastebasket liner with the ice in it. The second is for the cap. No need for the tongs here, he's already handled the item. He puts it in the baggie, zips it closed, marks the date, notes the nature of the evidence on the pad. The third bag is for the brown wrapping paper. He holds it up for a moment in the tongs, examining the bogus bird stamps. "Manufactured by Domino" is printed below each picture, but that's all. No restaurant name, nothing of that sort. Into the baggie, zip it closed, mark the date, note the nature of the evidence. He sweeps up the feathers and puts them in a fourth baggie. There are more feathers in the box. He picks the box up with the tongs, dumps the feathers inside onto the dustpan, and then his heart takes a sudden hard leap in his chest, seeming to knock against the left side of his rib cage like a fist. Something is written on the box's bottom. The same Sharpie marker has been used to make the same straggling letters. And whoever wrote this knew who he was writing to, not the outer Jack Sawyer, or else he, the fisherman, would have no doubt called him Hollywood. This message is addressed to the inner man, and to the child who was here before Jack Hollywood Sawyer was ever thought of. "Try Ed's Eats and Dogs, Coppiceman. Your fiend, the fisherman." "Your fiend," Jack murmurs. "Yes." He picks up the box with the tongs and puts it into the second wastebasket liner. He doesn't have any baggies quite big enough for it. Then he gathers all the evidence beside him in a neat little pile. This stuff always looks the same, at once grisly and prosaic, like the kind of photographs you used to see in those true crime magazines. He goes inside and dials Henry's number. He's afraid he'll get Mrs. Morton, but it turns out to be Henry instead, thank God. His current fit of ratism has apparently passed, although there's a residue. Even over the phone, Jack can hear the faint thump and bray of electrical guitars. He knows Ed's Eats well, Henry says, but why in the world would Jack want to know about a place like that? It's nothing but a wreck now. Ed Gilbertson died quite a time ago, and there are people in French Landing who'd call that a blessing, Jack. The place was a ptomaine palace, if there ever was one, a gut ache waiting to happen. You'd have expected the Board of Health to shut him down, but Ed knew people. Dale Gilbertson, for one. The two of them related, Jack asks. And when Henry replies, "Fuck yeah," something his friend would never say in the ordinary course of things, Jack understands that while Henry may have avoided a migraine this time, that rat is still running in his head. Jack has heard similar bits of George Rathbun pop out from time to time, unexpected fat exultations from Henry's slim throat. And there is the way Henry often says goodbye, throwing a ding-dong or ivy-divy over his shoulder. That's just the chic, the shake, the shook coming up for air. "Where exactly is it?" Jack asks. "That's hard to say," Henry replies. He now sounds a bit testy. "Out by the farm equipment place, Gultz's? As I recall, the driveway's so long you might as well call it an access road. And if there ever was a sign, it's long gone. When Ed Gilbertson sold his last microbe-infested chili dog, Jack, you were probably in the first grade. What's all this about?" Jack knows that what he's thinking of doing is ridiculous by normal investigatory standards. You don't invite a John Q to a crime scene, especially not a murder scene. But this is no normal investigation. He has one piece of bagged evidence that he recovered in another world. How's that for abnormal? Of course, he can find the long-defunct Ed's Eats. Someone at Gultz's will no doubt point him right at it. But the fisherman just sent me one of Irma Freneau's sneakers, Jack says, with Irma's foot still inside it. Henry's initial response is a deep, sharp intake of breath. "Henry, are you all right?" "Yes." Henry's voice is shocked but steady. "How terrible for the girl and her mother," he pauses. "And for you, for Dale," another pause, "for this town." "Yes." "Jack, do you want me to take you to Ed's?" Henry can do that, Jack knows, easy as pie, ivy-divy. And let's get real, why did he call Henry in the first place? "Yes," he says. "Have you called the police?" "No." "He'll ask me why not, and what will I say? That I don't want Bobby Dulac, Tom Lund, and the rest of them tromping around out there, mixing their scents with the doer's scent until I get a chance to smell for myself? That I don't trust a mother's son of them not to fuck things up, and that includes Dale himself?" But Henry doesn't ask. "I'll be standing at the end of my driveway," he said. "Just tell me when." Jack calculates his remaining chores with the evidence, chores that will end with stowing everything in the lockbox in the bed of his truck. Reminds himself to take his cell phone, which usually does nothing but stand on its little charging device in his study. He'll want to call everything in as soon as he has seen Irma's remains in situ and finish that vital first walkthrough. Let Dale and his boys come then. Let them bring along the high school marching band if they want to. He glances at his watch and sees that it's almost 8 o'clock. How did it get late so early? Distances are shorter in the other place, this he remembers. But does time go faster as well? Or has he simply lost track? "I'll be there at 8:15, Jack says. "And when we get to Ed's Eats, you're going to sit in my truck like a good little boy until I tell you you can get out." "Understood, Mon Capitan." Ding dong. Jack hangs up and heads back out to the porch. Things aren't going to turn out the way Jack hopes. He's not going to get that clear first look and smell. In fact, by this afternoon, the situation in French Landing, volatile already, will be on the verge of spinning out of control. Although there are many factors at work here, the chief cause of this latest escalation will be the mad Hungarian. There's a dose of good old small-town humor in this nickname, like calling the skinny bank clerk Big Joe or the trifocal-wearing bookstore proprietor Hawkeye. Arnold Hrabowski, at 5'6" and 150 pounds, is the smallest man on Dale Gilbertson's current roster. In fact, he's the smallest person on Dale's current roster, as both Debbie Anderson and Pam Stevens outweigh him and stand taller. At 6'1", Debbie could eat scrambled eggs off Arnold Hrabowski's head. The mad Hungarian is also a fairly inoffensive fellow, the sort of guy who continues to apologize for giving tickets, no matter how many times Dale has told him that this is a very bad policy, and who has been known to start interrogations with such unfortunate phrases as, "Excuse me, but I was wondering..." As a result, Dale keeps him on desk as much as possible. Or downtown, where everyone knows him and most treat him with absent respect. He tours the county grammar schools as officer friendly. The little ones, unaware that they are getting their first lessons on the evils of pot from the mad Hungarian, adore him. When he gives tougher lectures on dope, drink, and reckless driving at the high school, the kids doze or pass notes, although they do think the federally funded DARE car he drives, a low, sleek Pontiac with Just Say No emblazoned on the doors, is way cool. Basically, Officer Hrabowski is about as exciting as a tuna on white hold the mayo. But in the 70s, you see, there was this relief pitcher for St. Louis, and then the Kansas City Royals, a very fearsome fellow indeed, and his name was Al Hrabowski. He stalked rather than walked in from the bullpen, and before beginning to pitch, usually in the ninth inning with the bases juiced and the game on the line, Al Hrabowski would turn from the plate, lower his head, clench his fists, and pump them once very hard, psyching himself up. Then he would turn and begin throwing nasty fastballs, many of them within kissing distance of the batter's chins. He was, of course, called the Mad Hungarian, and even a blind man could see he was the best damn reliever in the majors. And, of course, Arnold Hrabowski is now known, must be known, as the Mad Hungarian. He even tried to grow a Fu Manchu mustache a few years back, like the one the famed reliever wore. But whereas Al Hrabowski's Fu was as fearsome as Zulu war paint, Arnold's only provoked chuckles. A Fu sprouting on that mild accountant's face, just imagine. And so he shaved it off. The Mad Hungarian of French Landing is not a bad fellow. He does his absolute level best. And under normal circumstances, his level best is good enough. But these aren't ordinary days in French Landing. These are the slippery slippage days, the Abala Apopanax days, and he is exactly the sort of officer of whom Jack is afraid. And this morning he is, quite without meaning to, going to make a bad situation very much worse. The call from the fisherman comes into the 911 phone at 8:10 a.m., while Jack is finishing his notes on the yellow legal pad, and Henry is strolling down his driveway, smelling the summer morning with great pleasure, in spite of the shadow Jack's news has cast over his mind. Unlike some of the officers, Bobby Dulac, for instance, the Mad Hungarian reads the script taped next to the 911 phone word for word. Arnold Hrabowski. Hello, this is the French Landing Police Department. Officer Hrabowski speaking. You've dialed 911. Do you have an emergency? Unintelligible sound. Throat clearing. A.H. Hello, this is Officer Hrabowski answering on 911. Do you call her? Hello, asswipe. A.H. Who is this? Do you have an emergency? C. You have an emergency. Not me, you. A.H. Who is this, please? C. Your worst nightmare. A.H. Sir, could I ask you to identify yourself? C. Abala. Abala Dune. Phonetic. A.H. Sir, I don't see. I'm the fisherman. Silence. C. What's wrong? Scared? You ought to be scared. A.H. Sir, there are penalties for false C. There are whips in hell and change in Sheol. Caller may be saying Sheol. A.H. Sir, if I could have your name, see, my name is Legion. My number is many. I am a rat under the floor of the universe. Robert Frost said that. Caller laughs. A.H. Sir, if you hold, I can put on my chief C. Shut up and listen, asswipe. Your tape running? I hope so. I could shag, caller may be saying scram, but word is indistinct, it if I wanted to, but I don't want to. A.H. Sir, I... C. Kiss my scrot, you monkey. I left you one, and I'm tired of waiting for you to find her. Try Ed's Eats and Dogs. Might be a little rotten now, but when she was new, she was very... Caller rolls R's, turning the word into very tasty. A.H. Where are you? Who is this? If this is a joke, C. Tell the coppiceman I said hello. When the call began, the Mad Hungarian's pulse was lub-dubbing along at a perfectly normal 68 beats a minute. When it ends at 8:12, Arnold Hrabowski's ticker is in overdrive. His face is pale. Halfway through the call, he looked at the caller ID readout and wrote down the number displayed there with a hand shaking so badly that the numbers jigged up and down over three lines on his pad. When the fisherman hangs up and he hears the sound of an open line, Hrabowski is so flustered that he tries to dial the callback on the red phone, forgetting that 911 is a one-way street. His fingers strike the smooth plastic in front of the phone, and he drops it back into the cradle with a frightened curse. He looks at it like something that has bitten him. Hrabowski grabs the receiver from the black telephone beside 911, starts to punch in the callback, but his fingers betray him and hit two numbers at once. He curses again, and Tom Lund, passing by with a cup of coffee, says, "What's wrong there, Arnie?" "Get Dale!" the mad Hungarian shouts, startling Tom so badly he spills coffee on his fingers. "Get him out here now!" "What the hell's wrong with you? Now, goddammit!" Tom stares at Hrabowski a moment longer, eyebrows raised, then goes to tell Dale that the mad Hungarian seems to have really gone mad. The second time Hrabowski tries, he succeeds in dialing the callback number. It rings, and it rings some more. Dale Gilbertson appears with his own cup of coffee. There are dark circles under his eyes, and the lines at the corners of his mouth are a lot more prominent than they used to be. "Arnie, what's playback the last call?" Arnold Hrabowski says. "I think it was... Hello?" He barks this last, sitting forward behind the dispatch desk and shoving papers every which way. "Hello, who is this?" Listens. "It's the police, that's who it is. Officer Hrabowski, FLPD. Now you talk to me, who is this?" Dale, meanwhile, has got the earphones on his head and is listening to the most recent call to French Landing 911 with mounting horror. "Oh, dear God," he thinks. His first impulse, the very first, is to call Jack Sawyer and ask for help, to bawl for it like a little kid with his hand caught in a door. Then he tells himself to take hold that this is his job, like it or not, and that he had better take hold and try to do it. Besides, Jack has gone up to Arden with Fred Marshall to see Fred's crazy wife. At least that was the plan. Cops, meanwhile, are clustering around the dispatch desk. Lund, Cheetah, Stevens. What Dale sees when he looks at them is nothing but big eyes and pale, bewildered faces. And the ones on patrol, the ones currently off duty, no better. With the possible exception of Bobby Dulac, no better. He feels despair as well as horror. Oh, this is a nightmare. A truck with no brakes rolling downhill toward a crowded school playground. He pulls the earphones off, tearing a small cut by his ear, not feeling it. "Where'd it come from?" he asks Hrabowski. The mad Hungarian has hung up the telephone and is just sitting there, stunned. Dale grabs his shoulder and gives it a shake. "Where'd it come from?" "The 7-Eleven," the mad Hungarian replies, and Dale hears Danny Cheetah grunt. Not too far from where the Marshall boy's bike disappeared, in other words. "I just spoke with Mr. Rajan Patel, the day clerk. He says the callback number belongs to the payphone just outside." "Did he see who made the call?" "No, he was out back taking a beer delivery." "You positive Patel himself didn't?" "Yeah, he's got an Indian accent, heavy. The guy on 911, Dale, you heard him, he sounded like anybody." "What's going on?" Pam Stevens asks. She has a good idea, though. They all do. It's just a question of details. "What's happened?" Because it's the quickest way to get them up to speed, Dale replays the call, this time on speaker. In the stunned silence that follows, Dale says, "I'm going out to Ed Zeitz. Tom, you're coming with me." "Yes, sir," Tom Lund says. He looks almost ill with excitement. "Four more cruisers to follow me." Most of Dale's mind is frozen. This procedural stuff skates giddily on top of the ice. "I'm okay at procedure and organization," he thinks. "It's just catching the goddamn psycho murderer that's giving me a little trouble." "All pairs. Danny, you and Pam in the first. Leave 5 minutes after Tom and I do. 5 minutes, by the clock, and no lights or siren. We're going to keep this quiet just as long as we can." Danny Cheetah and Pam Stevens look at each other, nod, then look back at Dale. Dale is looking at Arnold, the mad Hungarian Hrabowski. He ticks off three more pairs, ending with Dit Jesperson and Bobby Dulac. Bobby is the only one he really wants out there. The others are just insurance, and, God grant it not be necessary, crowd control. All of them are to come at five-minute intervals. "Let me go out, too," Arnie Hrabowski pleads. "Come on, boss, what do you say?" Dale opens his mouth to say he wants Arnie right where he is, but then he sees the hopeful look in those watery brown eyes. Even in his own deep distress, Dale can't help responding to that at least a little. For Arnie, police life is too often standing on the sidewalk while the parade goes by. Some parade, he thinks. I'll tell you what, Arn, he says, when you finish all your other calls, buzz Debbie. If you can get her in here, you can come out to Ed's. Arnold nods excitedly, and Dale almost smiles. The mad Hungarian will have Debbie in here by 9:30, he guesses, even if he has to drag her by the hair like alley-oop. Who do I pair with, Dale? Come by yourself, Dale says. In the dare car, why don't you? But, Arnie, if you leave this desk without relief waiting to drop into the chair the second you leave it, you'll be looking for a new job come tomorrow. Oh, don't worry, Hrabowski says. And Hungarian or not, in his excitement he sounds positively Swedish. Nor is that surprising, since Centralia, where he grew up, was once known as Swede Town. Come on, Tom, Dale says. We'll grab the evidence kit on our, boss? What, Arnie? Meaning, of course, what now? Should I call those state police guys brown and black? Danny Cheetah and Pam Stevens snicker. Tom smiles. Dale doesn't do either. His heart, already in the cellar, now goes even lower. Sub-basement, ladies and gentlemen, false hopes on your left, lost causes on your right. Last stop, everybody out. Perry Brown and Jeff Black. He had forgotten them. How funny. Brown and Black, who would now almost certainly take his case away from him. They're still out at the Paradise Motel, the mad Hungarian goes on. Although I think the FBI guy went back to Milwaukee. And County, the Hungarian plows relentlessly along. Don't forget them. You want me to call the ME first or the evidence wagon? The evidence wagon is a blue Ford Econoline van packed with everything from quick-drying plaster for taking tire impressions to a rolling video studio. Stuff the French Landing PD will never have access to. Dale stands where he is, head lowered, looking dismally at the floor. They are going to take the case away from him. With every word Hrabowski says, that is clearer. And suddenly he wants it for his own. In spite of how he hates it and how it scares him, he wants it with all his heart. The fisherman is a monster, but he's not a county monster, a state monster, or a Federal Bureau of Investigation monster. The fisherman is a French Landing monster, Dale Gilbertson's monster, and he wants to keep the case for reasons that have nothing to do with personal prestige or even the practical matter of holding on to his job. He wants him because the fisherman is an offense against everything Dale wants and needs and believes in. Those are things you can't say out loud without sounding corny and stupid, but they are true for all that. He feels a sudden, foolish anger at Jack. If Jack had come on board sooner, maybe... And if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. He has to notify County, if only to get the medical examiner out at the scene, and he has to notify the state police and the persons of Detectives Brown and Black as well. But not until he has a look at what's out there in the field beyond Goltz's, at what the fisherman has left. By God, not until then. And perhaps has one final swing at the bastard. Get our guys rolling at 5-minute intervals, he said, just as I told you. Then get Debbie in the dispatch chair. Have her call state and county. Arnold Hrabowski's puzzled face makes Dale feel like screaming, but somehow he retains his patience. I want some lead time. Oh, Arnie says. And then when he actually does get it, oh. And don't tell anyone other than our guys about the call or our response. Anyone. You'd likely start a panic, do you understand? Absolutely, boss, says the Hungarian. Dale glances at the clock. 8:26 a.m. Come on, Tom, he says. Let's get moving. Tempus fugit. The mad Hungarian has never been more efficient, and things fall into place like a dream. Even Debbie Anderson is a good sport about the desk. And yet, through it all, the voice on the phone stays with him. Hoarse, raspy, with just a tinge of accent, the kind anyone living in this part of the world might pick up. Nothing unusual about that. Yet it haunts him. Not that the guy called him an asswipe. He's been called much worse by your ordinary Saturday night drunks. But some of the other stuff. There are whips in hell and chains in Sheol. My name is Legion. Stuff like that. And Abala. What was an Abala? Arnold Hrabowski doesn't know. He only knows that the very sound of it in his head makes him feel bad and scared. It's like a word in a secret book, the kind you might use to conjure up a demon. When he gets the willies, there's only one person who can take them away, and that's his wife. He knows Dale told him not to tell anybody about what was going down, and he understands the reasons, but surely the chief didn't mean Paula. They've been married 20 years, and Paula isn't like another person at all. She's like the rest of him. So, more in order to dispel his bad case of the willies than to gossip, let's at least give Arnold that much, the mad Hungarian makes the terrible mistake of trusting his wife's discretion. He calls Paula and tells her that he spoke to the fisherman not half an hour ago. Yes, really, the fisherman. He tells her about the body that is supposedly waiting for Dale and Tom Lund out at Ed Zeet's. She asks him if he's all right. Her voice is trembling with awe and excitement, and the mad Hungarian finds this quite satisfying, since he's feeling awed and excited himself. They talk a little more, and when Arnold hangs up, he feels better. The terror of that rough, strangely knowing voice on the phone has receded a little. Paula Hrabowski is discretion itself, the very soul of discretion. She tells only her two best friends about the call Arnie got from the fisherman and the body at Ed Zeet's, and swears them both to secrecy. Both say they will never tell a soul, and this is why, 1 hour later, even before the state police and the county medical and forensics guys have been called, everyone knows that the police have found a slaughterhouse out at Ed Zeet's. Half a dozen murdered kids. Maybe more.